From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. California announced this week that as a result of the state's budget crisis, nearly 22,000 teachers have received pink slips. School budgets in the Golden State have been cut by nearly $18 billion in the last 2 years, with more pain on the way. NPR's Larry Abramson reports that California, along with many other states, are also having to rethink ideas that made sense in more prosperous times.
Budget-wise, California schools are up a creek without a paddle or a life vest. Tom Buddy is superintendent of the Central Union High School District in far southern California. He says he has nickeled and dimed his budget every which way he can think of.
Bottled water we stopped doing, stopped buying textbooks, but we did very carefully not lay off anybody.
But it wasn't enough, so Buddy turned to the teachers' union.
We said, hey, across-the-board pay cuts, furlough days, reduction in school year, increase in class size.
The union went for bigger classes because it saved teachers' jobs. California had actually been rewarding districts for reducing class size, but many districts have given up on that support, saying the extra funding they get doesn't make up for the cost. Tom Buddy says he hates to see class sizes go up, but he's glad he had the flexibility to take that step. But if Buddy were a superintendent in Florida, he wouldn't even have the option of increasing class size. Bill Montford, head of the Florida Association of District School Superintendents, says voters there passed an ironclad amendment to the state constitution in 2002.
It's real simple. If you have a 19th child that shows up, you cannot put the child in a class where there's 18 already.
Instead, you have to hire another teacher, maybe even build another classroom. Dominique Calabro of the watchdog group Florida Tax Watch says it has cost the state a fortune.
Just shy of $20 billion. It's made it difficult to retain, let alone give pay raises for highly meritorious teachers and principals.
So his group and others are pushing to undo the amendment. It's particularly important now that the crash of housing prices has eaten holes in Florida's school budget. But he will face a fight from those who still support smaller classes, like many parents and teachers. Mark Pudlow is a spokesman for the teachers' union, the Florida Education Association.
We still believe you have one chance to educate your children, and the state is near the bottom when you compare it to the other states as far as what we spend on education, and the voters were very clear in their intent.
And many states are having to rethink well-intentioned education ideas. In Michigan, tough times have forced the state to back away from an expensive obligation. They cut funding for the Promise Scholarship, which offered college grants to all students with good grades. In Washington state, several popular scholarships are also in jeopardy because of budget problems. Some states are looking at granting relief from costly mandates, such as New York requirements that schools deploy defibrillators in schools or conduct internal audits. In California, mandates cost schools over $400 million a year. 51 different requirements order schools to educate students about AIDS or to notify parents in writing if a student is truant. Jim Soland is with the state's Legislative Analyst's Office. His research shows that mandates like the truancy notification requirement stay on the books long after their effectiveness has been questioned.
A form letter is sent out that's reimbursed at $18 per letter, and signs indicate that it does very little to actually increase parental involvement or reduce dropout rates.
California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger is considering suspending the mandates to help schools get through this very tough budget year. That hasn't happened yet, and even if it does, the mandates will live on, and they may return next year when money will still be tight. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. The NCAA tournament is all about upsets, Cinderella stories. Well, for every Cinderella, there are brackets full of teams that come close to pulling off the shocker, but don't. NPR's Mike Pesca has the story of two underdogs from the first round of play, a team that won and a team that didn't.
204 years after his death, the name Robert Morris lives on. And depending on what Karan Abraham did with a basketball in a gym in Providence yesterday, Robert Morris was looking to survive a bit further. The Robert Morris University Colonials found themselves tied with Villanova with a minute left in the game. In the stands, Clarence Abraham, Karan's dad, was brimming with hope.
Well, I knew 18.5-point underdogs. I know we can prevail that. We're not that far underdogs on them, but if we played a good game, perfect game, we can pull this upset.
Right across the aisle from Mr. Abraham was Gregory Dellomo, the school's president, and he knew a big win could mean a lot.
It'll be wonderful for the students and obviously the name recognition. The whole country's watching this game right now, I assume. So we're ready to finish this off in 0.9 seconds, maybe going to overtime and win it there.
The Colonials did take the game into overtime, but Villanova's superior athleticism took over. Abraham repeatedly found Villanova's shot blockers erasing what would normally be made baskets against RMU's usual foes. Villanova won by 3. Coaches from small schools know what a tournament run can mean for future job prospects. Administrators know what it means in terms of publicity, and students never want the party to end. But the beauty of March Madness is that a new dream comes along all the time. Not 6 hours after President Dellomo exited his seat in the arena, Ohio's president, Roderick McDavis, was literally in the same spot. His Bobcats, a 14 seed, were spelling trouble for Georgetown, and McDavis was thrilled with all eyes on Ohio.
I think it helps us not only in terms of applications, but in terms of visibility and people getting to know who we are and what we're all about.
On the other side of the arena, Georgetown fan Andrew Rennie was playing the part of unfazed favorite.
We've been down by much bigger deficits against much, much better teams. I undoubtedly think that we'll come back from this, especially because they're shooting about 70% right now and they can't keep that up.
Actually, Ohio shot 71.4% on three-pointers in the second half, thus becoming the first day's biggest Cinderella. For Carl Bassett, whose son Armin led Ohio with 32 points, it was simply
the best moment, the best feeling in the world. I mean, I dragged my bank account to come to see, but I couldn't think of anything else better to spend my money on.
Armin had not only won a game, in his mind, he justified his decision to transfer from Indiana 2 years ago and then to leave the University of Alabama at Birmingham for Ohio last year. This is why, he said in the locker room after the game, he has a tattoo that says, against all odds.
I left Indiana, people wrote me off and, you know, tried to slander my name. I went to UAB, had to leave there, more slander, and I got to carry a chip on my shoulder.
And of course, by rehabilitating the name on the back of his jersey, Bassett put the name on the front, Ohio, on the lips of people nationwide. Other schools like Robert Morris strive to return to the tournament for the chance to make everyone remember their names. Mike Pesca, NPR News, Providence, Rhode Island.
Swedish writer and activist Stieg Larsson was a passionate leftist who wrote about what he saw as the flaws in Swedish society. When he died in 2004, he left behind 3 unpublished novels about a crime-solving journalist who teams up with a punk computer hacker. The novels, published posthumously as the Millennium Trilogy, have sold more than 21 million copies worldwide. They've also been made into Swedish movies, all hugely popular in Europe. The first of those movies opens today in the U.S. Bob Mondello reviews The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Walking through a Stockholm square, recently disgraced journalist Mikael Blomqvist can't escape his own image. His face, accompanied by the headline, Guilty, stares back from newsstands, from billboard-sized video screens, and though Blomqvist doesn't realize it, from the viewfinder of a camera held by a fierce-looking, leather-clad punkette named Lisbeth. Blomqvist's crime was investigating a powerful industrialist who sued him for libel. Lisbeth, who's been brutalized enough to instinctively side with the powerless, has taken an interest. Hacking into the journalist's computer, she discovers he's now investigating what even Swedes would consider a cold case, the disappearance 4 decades earlier of another industrialist's niece. Soon they're working in tandem, Blomqvist taking an old-school shoe-leather approach to crime-solving, while Lisbeth mines the internet for clues.
Mind up.
En otäck mordgåta som satte myror i huvudet på polisen i november 1954.
Jag hade inte vi ett Magda citat.
Stieg Larsson's novels are rife with sexual violence and violent sex, but they're also mystery thrillers in the Agatha Christie sense, in this case with an isolated estate, skulking suspects, hidden motives, and alibis. But the author's also a sharp social critic, so what his characters uncover isn't just crime, but a whole dark side to Swedish society. Decades of hidden fascism, corporate corruption, religious atrocities, and most of all, a terrible, sadistic misogyny. The film's title in Swedish means men who hate women, and it's entirely apt. Lisbeth, pierced, tattooed, and played with a sometimes uncontrolled ferocity by Noomi Rapace, qualifies as both a victim of male violence and a violent avenger of it. This makes her a lot more compelling than her comparatively passive partner, something that Hollywood will doubtless find it necessary to remedy when Girl with a Dragon Tattoo gets remade in English, with George Clooney, Brad Pitt, and Johnny Depp reportedly interested in playing Blomqvist. You can pretty much count on a more active male lead, along with Tinseltown's customary approach to moral questions and a decrease in cultural authenticity. A cold case in a frigid landscape, in other words, will likely get hotted up. And unless you have moral objections to subtitles, that's an argument for catching the Scandinavian original. I'm Bob Mondello.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. ABC News is facing sharp criticism because it paid hundreds of thousands of dollars to a woman accused of killing her daughter. NPR's David Folkenflik has the story behind the money.
The disclosure came yesterday in a state court in Florida. Attorney Jose Baez was explaining to a judge why his client, Casey Anthony, needed help in paying legal bills. Anthony is on trial for killing her 2-year-old daughter, Kaylee, and Baez had to explain publicly where her past funds came from. It's awfully tough to hear, but as the judge made him reiterate, he's saying $200,000 came from ABC News.
From where, sir?
ABC.
From the ABC News?
On September 5th, 2008, Casey Anthony was released from a Florida jail on bail for charges of child neglect and endangerment. That day, ABC promised an inside look at the doubts growing around the young mother. Here was Elizabeth Vargas on Good Morning America.
Even if you think you know the details, there are new insights and new exclusive intimate pictures like these.
Anthony was indicted for murder a month later. Today, ABC News declined requests for interviews, but the network released a 2-sentence statement confirming it paid Anthony for exclusive access to the family's home videos and photographs. ABC noted it received no interview with her. The disclosure is nonetheless a bombshell in journalistic circles. Lawrence Grossman is the former president of NBC News.
It is, I regard, as a totally unethical journalistic practice to pay people for access that way.
He says it's particularly galling to see the revelation of such a large payment so soon after the announcement that ABC was slashing hundreds of jobs to save money. Grossman says such a hidden payment undermines the network's
trustworthiness, integrity, honesty of reporting in a serious way.
Staffers at ABC News, speaking on condition of anonymity, say they found it equally appalling. All the major network news divisions have a rule against paying people for interviews, yet many of them bend the rules as they chase big stories. NBC News recently flew a man back from Brazil with his son on a GE corporate jet after an international custody battle. He soon appeared on NBC. Yet Casey Anthony received a big payday from ABC, and the network never told viewers.
I think they should say exactly what they did, whom they paid, what they paid. They should give their reasoning for pay.
Geneva Overholzer is a former ombudsman for The Washington Post. Overholzer says she doesn't like checkbook journalism because interviewees can tailor what they say for money. But she says,
the fundamental ethic in this case is transparency. To me, if ABC had been forthright about having made payments, then readers could, and viewers, I'm sorry, could judge for themselves.
Back in September 2008, when ABC did have a chance to be transparent, here's what Chris Cuomo asked Elizabeth Vargas on Good Morning America.
Who bailed her out this time?
We're told it's a production company out of Tennessee, perhaps, that might have been interested in buying the rights to her story, her personal story. These are not insignificant sums of money, $500,000.
But Vargas never told her viewers that just days earlier, ABC had done pretty much the same thing. David Folkenflik, NPR News, New York.
They
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Healthcare overhaul hangs in the balance this weekend. President Obama goes to Capitol Hill this afternoon to meet with House Democrats. On the eve of tomorrow's vote, Democrats are attempting to pass a sweeping overhaul of the nation's healthcare system, despite unified opposition from congressional Republicans. Coming up, we'll talk to House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer to ask him bluntly if they have the votes. First, at a rally in Northern Virginia yesterday, Mr. Obama suggested that overhaul will be more popular once the political arm twisting is over, and Pierre Scott Horsley reports.
President Obama told supporters at George Mason University in Virginia, tomorrow's health care vote is the capstone of a debate that's consumed not just the last year in Washington, but much of the last century, beginning with the Republican president who first called for universal health care coverage, Teddy Roosevelt.
The time for reform is now. We have waited long enough. We have waited long enough. And in just a few days, a century-long struggle will culminate in a historic vote.
The president characterized the health care plan being pushed by Democrats as the successor to a long line of bold government initiatives, from civil rights to Social Security, that are widely embraced today, but which were just as controversial when initially proposed.
There were cynics that warned that Medicare would lead to a government takeover of our entire health care system, and that it didn't have much support in the polls, but Democrats and Republicans refused to back down, and they made sure that our seniors had the health care that they needed and could have some basic peace of mind.
Nancy Dare is one of those seniors on Medicare and grateful for it. She came to the rally because she says Americans under the age of 65 also deserve guaranteed health care coverage.
I have a friend who just had a back operation. She's in her 40s, and her insurance company is going to pay $6,000 on a $20,000 operation. I'm here because of all the people who have no way to get insurance.
Dare says she's confident the House will approve the health care bill tomorrow, even though she admits it's not perfect.
I'm very positive. I don't think we're going to get everything that we want, but if we get something, it'll be a blessing for everyone.
Outside the rally, Heather West waved a protest sign and pushed a stroller with her daughter, Claire. The stay-at-home mom says she's satisfied with the insurance she gets through her husband's work, and she doesn't want to take a chance on what she calls a social experiment. But even West seemed resigned to a House vote in favor of the health care measure.
They're going to slam it down our throats. This is Obama presidency rests on this. So he'll do whatever it takes, legal or illegal. He'll do it. And I don't want it. I am so mad. I can't tell you. I can't sleep at night. I'm so mad. Aren't I, Claire?
President Obama says the nation cannot afford not to make changes in its costly health care system. He argued once Americans get used to those changes, the year-long battle leading up to this vote will be forgotten.
As messy as this process is, as frustrating as this process is, as ugly as this process can be, when we have faced such decisions in our past, this nation, time and time again, has chosen to extend its promise to more of its people.
Of course, the lawmakers Mr. Obama is hoping to persuade this afternoon don't have the luxury of that long historical perspective. They'll have to face voters in November. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.